Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast, and this week we return to the subject of value investing in US equities. This means we'll be spending a bit of time talking about areas such as financials and energy, and we will be doing so with a guest fund manager from BNY Mellon, John Baylor. But before we get into the investment debate, please first listen to our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone, welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're going to be looking at the US equity market, particularly those areas that fall into the value style and perhaps paying off a bit of income. And we're doing that with John Baylor, the lead manager on the BNY Mellon US Equity Income Fund, joining us from the States. John, thanks very much for finding the time. How are you?
Thanks, I'm good.
Good. Well, good on the basis that value is actually having a little bit better time of it in the shorter term. We're going to come back to that, perhaps, the challenges in value and growth. But just to let you know what else we're looking at on the call, I think within the value sphere, we'll certainly be taking a look at financials and energy and any offshoots from there. So, John, we'll come back. We'll get straight into the investment conversation. I guess when we think about value in the US, we'll think about banks. And there is some evidence that this story is working, but it hasn't been a great 18 months. I don't know if you want to sort of set the scene as to why banks have been challenged, and then we'll get into why you see they represent such value.
Great. Yeah, happy to do that. So, you know, the U.S. banks, like you said, in the past 18 months, you know, have struggled a little bit. And one of the reasons for that is people have been very concerned about an imminent recession in the U.S. market. And, you know, what that portends for, you know, interest rates, inversion of the yield curve, credit costs. My belief is the market is really too focused on the last war. And the last war is the financial crisis of 2008, where you had a systemic issue with the mortgage market. And it really took down a lot of banks. And you know, really significantly impacted their book values. My belief is the next downturn, if we have one, and I'm not predicting one right now, but if we do, it's going to look a lot more like 2001. In March 2001, we did have a little bit of a downturn. And what happened in the 2 years, kind of before, the year before 2001, the year after 2001 is, you know, you had an inverted yield curve, you had lower interest rates, you were able to outperform for these banks. And you actually saw absolute positive performance for a lot of these banks during that period, even in a very, you know, dire environment of lower interest rates, inverted yield curve. And I will mention higher credit costs, which is something that people focus on now. So I think a lot of these banks, even though that's been very negative, you know, people have been talking very negatively about, you know, some of these issues. I don't think it's as bad as what people are saying. And we saw some evidence in this earnings season where, you know, you mentioned that our performance had started to pick up in April, and which it had. And a lot of that had to do with, you know, kind of the positive outlooks for these financials, where they're buying back so much stock, significant amounts of stock, and their businesses are much more stable than what a lot of investors anticipated. And remember, some of the big banks that we own, they're investing so much in technology that they're able to pick up share, show some loan growth, and to really offset, you know, some of the net interest margin pressure from you know, now the forecast is no interest rate increases in the U.S. for the rest of the year. So we think they're on solid footing, a lot of these banks, and we're very happy with our positioning.
Okay, so the outside of financial crisis, actually banks can do a reasonable job in the midst of a normal quote unquote recession. But presumably, you believe that environment is not an imminent threat anyway. Is that the case?
Yeah. So the way I look at it, it's a win-win for positioning. It's always dangerous to say that in the investment market, but. I think the banks, I mean, what's nice is a lot of these cyclical areas of the market, including the financials, they're already discounting a downturn in terms of their valuation. So if it happens, you've already discounted it. And so the stocks, you know, won't do poorly at all. And with the type of capital returns they have, you know, trading at 8-9 times earnings, they can buy back a tremendous amount of stock and grow their earnings even in a downturn. My forecast is we don't have a recession, and you know these companies do okay. Interest rates start to slowly move up, so you're going to see a couple of tailwinds. They're cutting a lot of costs. They're growing their loans. They're picking up share in the U.S., especially versus a lot of the European banks, both on the you know capital markets front, and just you know in the you know, in those areas of the business that they compete with internationally. And we think there's a lot of growth to come in excess of even the S&P 500, and you're paying less. So we think there's a lot of opportunity there.
And you already touched on earnings, because we are in this sort of, coming to an end of the earnings reporting season. But in terms of banks, it can be a little bit confusing, especially those that aren't based in the US. You know, you have some banks that are more domestically focused, those that are more international, have more of an international footprint. And of course, there's the investment banking side and trading divisions, capital markets divisions. You know, how would you sort of slice up what we could learn from earnings seasons in the, you know, not necessarily focusing on just that quarter, but how that affects the sort of trends in those themes?
Yeah. So I'm a big believer that the biggest banks, because of their huge investment in technology, that they're going to be able to grow faster than the smaller banks. So on the margin, you know, we're more exposed to the big multinational financial institutions currently. They also have some of the best capital positions, so they can return more capital back to shareholders. They have very big dividend yields and very big share buyback programs because they're so well capitalized. So, you know, we really like the bigger banks. But in general, we're optimistic in all the financials. One of the reasons that we like them too is we think the housing market is starting to improve.
Because this was a big question mark in 2008, or disappointment rather than question mark, I guess, because the economy seemed to be doing so well, and yet housing had seemed to go through something of a hiccup. That was sort of interest rate related.
That's right. In 2018. There's no doubt the housing market slowed. You saw it with a lot of the home builder stocks. They really underperformed during that period. And the reason they were underperforming is because order growth started to slow meaningfully. And primarily that was interest rate driven. That was, you know, the 10-year moving up you know, in excess of 3% in the U.S. And that started to slow that ordering pattern down from a lot of consumers in the U.S. But ever since the Federal Reserve went on hold in December and the 10-year pulled back and we're back, you know, below 3%, around 2.6 currently, that has really helped out the housing market, and you're starting to see some real improvement. You know, I listened to a lot of the home builder calls during the last, you know, month here, and they're saying all the same things, which was February got better than January. March was better than February. And April is as strong as March. So you're really starting to see, and this is the important time period for these home builders, the spring selling season. This is where a lot of the homes get sold. You're really starting to see an acceleration as those interest rates had pulled back a little bit. So, and inventories are very low. So we're very optimistic on the housing front. We play that a couple of different ways in the portfolio. One of the ways is in a aggregate producer that that we own, that not only do they benefit from residential and non-res building, but we also get a big benefit from state and local spending. And in this GDP report that we saw of 3.2% that was just reported on Friday, one of the things that was highlighted in that report was very significant state and local spending. And we think a lot of that is going into highways, and that really benefits, you know, this aggregate producer we own in the portfolio.
So is there something sort of contradictory in rates and the banking story, in that as rates move higher, so it acts as a brake on the housing market and creates some problems or a slowdown in mortgage origination for banks versus, you know, and but also helps with net interest margins on what they can charge on existing loans and new loans versus, you know, when rates fall, then it's a better news for the mortgage side, but worse news for pricing. You know, what is it the interest rate environment is best for your banks or for the banking sector in general?
Yeah, there's there definitely is a bit of that offset, as you mentioned. You know, just a lot of our, especially our bigger banks, you know, mortgages just aren't a big enough piece of it to really offset significantly, you know, the lower rates. But in general, for our financials that we own, you know, we would like slow and steady interest rate increases. And there's one of the arguments that, you know, I've seen from a lot of, you know, very senior analysts that that look at the housing market, is it wasn't so much of that, you know, 3% going through the 10-year 3%, because, you know, you go back, there were 2 million housing starts, you know, in the early 1980s when interest rates were, you know, double, triple where they are today. So, you know, consumers, you know, will still buy buy homes almost in any interest rate environment. What they will slow down on is the magnitude of the increase. So we saw a huge increase in interest rates over the last year as the Fed had continued to raise. So I think that is more of the impact. And so if we just see slow and steady interest rate increases, I think you know, the consumer will get used to, you know, the current mortgage rates and will still you know, buy a new home. And I think what's so important for the housing market is, you know, do people have jobs, which they currently do? Are their incomes rising, which they currently are? The U.S. consumer is in a very healthy shape currently, and you know, we don't see that ending right now, and so that's why we're optimistic on a lot of the housing you know, businesses in the U.S.
So, you know, at the start of 2018, we were had an employment market in very good shape in the U.S., and we're in the midst of interest rate rises that were extremely slow and steady, and yet the housing market sort of fell over, or certainly went through a slowdown. Is that because it was longer dated interest rates that moved too far, too fast, or too fast, let's say? I mean, that sort of suggests that you're sort of more susceptible to sort of global growth conditions. Is that sort of fair? And maybe that side of the equation is looking a bit better now.
Yeah, well, I think global growth can do a little bit better here. You know, we're not experts necessarily on global, but we are seeing obviously some stimulus in China, which should help you know, China, and then should help you know, a lot of their partners, especially here in Europe. But in general, you know, I think what happened was the longer rates did move up. You know, as the Fed, I mean, the Fed was being fairly aggressive with the interest rate increases, and the market was assuming, you know, more to come. I mean, the market 6 months ago were expecting probably four more increases in the U.S., four more interest rate increases in the U.S. in 2019. I mean, we're down to zero now. So I think that is, you know, the big component of it. Because the market isn't expecting it, the yield curve is pretty flat. You know, the mortgage rates have come down enough where it just gets people to start buying again.
Okay. Right, we might take a switch. Let's talk about valuations, presumably. I mean, we've talked a bit about it, but the fundamentals look okay, but the valuations, where are we on your extensive veteran career? That's without being too offensive in looking at financials. Are we still talking? Are we still friends?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. No, that's fine. I am old and I've seen a lot of markets. I think financials look tremendous right now in terms of valuation. Are you looking on P basis? Are you looking on price to book basis, you know, relative to the U.S. market? They're really as good as they've ever been. And I think that correlates with what I'm seeing in the U.S. market, which is value looks very attractive to us right now. Value hasn't looked this attractive since the end of 1999, during the last time we had, you know, a real tech bubble that was created by a lot of these, you know, growth-oriented stocks, and people believing that growth was going to continue in the future. So, you know, we think that having a big chunk of financials gets you that value characteristic in the portfolio, which is important to have, especially, you know, if you have an index fund, which a lot of that, a lot of the S&P 500, what's driven the S&P 500 has been a lot of these growth-oriented stocks. And so a lot of people, even though, you know, they think it's an index fund, you have a decent amount of growth exposure now if you're just in an index fund. And I think it's very appropriate to offset that with some value exposure because, you know, that's where, in our view, the real opportunities are in the current market, and the value exposure really comes from financials.
Yeah, so financials is a big part of that value play, but not the only play. Perhaps of interest is your exposure, your overweight to index positions in energy. We're seeing the energy price back up again, and on seemingly got some good momentum. And certainly, the news flow suggests it's well supported. What's happening in terms of a reaction from the underlying businesses, and where in the energy sort of chain are you?
Yep. So we're very, you know, we're bullish, especially on the refiners in the U.S. You know, we think, like I said, the U.S. consumer's in good shape. We're seeing demand trends for gasoline to be very strong. We think the summer driving season in the United States is going to be good. We also think IMO 2020 is going to be a big beneficiary for a lot of these refiners. You're starting to see the crack spreads for the refiners start to expand a bit here.
So crack spreads, just for our audience benefit, I mean, that is the margin you make on the stuff that you produce from a barrel of oil. I mean,
that's correct.
The input cost for the refiner is the barrel of oil, and that has gone up. So you might have thought, sort of from a standing start, oh, I've got margin compression there.
But yeah.
Can you fill in the blanks there?
Yeah, so what happens is, you know, it's obviously their ability to price, you know, that oil that they're refining. And even if the oil price is higher, you know, if they've got some pricing power, if the demand is greater than the supply of those barrels of oil, you know, those margins, which is what we call the crack spread, you know, can expand even in a, you know, higher oil price environment. And
that's what we're in at the moment.
And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing oil prices move higher, but then we're also seeing, you know, that margin expand on what these refiners can make on any, you know, given barrel of oil producing into gasoline.
And that's a reflection of international, domestic?
It's really domestic demand, you know, we're starting to see here. And it's a reflection of supply. So there's been a lot of downtime. Exxon just reported their numbers, and they talked about significant refining downtime. And so that takes a lot of those gasoline supply out of the market. We were running excess inventory, gasoline inventories. That has totally went away over the last quarter here because of all the significant downtime that's been taken. So supply is is down and demand is up, and that leads to higher margins, higher crack spreads.
I mean, what about the majors there? I mean, there's a bit of dividend there, and maybe there is this valuation appeal because of the difference between what the market's pricing in terms of future earnings versus actually what the oil price is currently residing at.
So, we're lukewarm on the majors. We're not huge bulls. We think, you know, you can create some of the major portfolios with components of the majors. You know, so if you want refining, you can buy pure play refiners, which we all like. We like those refiners better than necessarily getting it through a major. If you want an E&P company, you can buy it you know, directly in E&P company. And a good example of that is, you know, there is a company that owns a, you know, a big chunk of, you know, Guyana, which Exxon owns. And this is a play that, you know, is really unseen of, unseen in the last 20 years. Just huge, huge potential. They continue to find significant amounts of oil down there in Guyana. And, you know, and this is a company that trades, you know, that we own in this portfolio around $60, a little over $60. We think by 2022, they can earn $9 a share in earnings and free cash flow. So that's only now, you know, a little over 2 years out. And the market, because it has been so short-term oriented, really focused on the companies that just generate the cash flow today and paying out the dividends today, and not focused more on the future, what dividend growth can be, you know, what the future cash flow prospects of business can be. We think there's a huge opportunity to own this company that that people just aren't willing to look out, you know, a couple of years. But it absolutely, every indication is they'll be generating a massive amount of earnings and free cash flow. So, you know, like that would be an example of, you know, we can find just better opportunities in the E&P space than necessarily the majors, and we can kind of create a major through owning an E&P company, a refiner, and, you know, maybe a chemical company. And we own, you know, some chemical companies too that we think are good.
Okay, well, I mean, my sort of final question would be, to those, I mean, those who are really sort of pro-growth, you know, I guess they would know where to go. But to those who say, you know, value stocks are sort of, it's old economy stocks, you know, they're missing out on all this disruption. I mean, presumably within this portfolio, or certainly you as a fund manager, you recognize that the world is changing. I mean, to what extent do your companies participate in the way that consumers and businesses are changing as a result of sort of, I guess, digital disruption or any other disruptive forces? I mean, you're not just going to be left behind by this story.
Well, it's such a good question, because as a value manager, I mean, we're dealing with secular value traps all the time. I mean, our whole job as a value manager is try to avoid those, you know, where, you know, our companies are getting really disintermediated. You know, a good example of that would be, you know, retail getting disintermediated. And, you know, in the past, it was, you know, newspapers. So unfortunately, we have been able to, you know, through good fundamental analysis, avoid some of those areas. So that's our job. You know, we look for those areas of the market that aren't going to get disintermediated by technology and that can use it to their benefit. An example of that would be the financials. We think they are currently using technology to gain a lot of share. You know, a lot of these big multinational financial companies are using technology to gain share and to lower costs as well. You don't have to open up as many branches. If anything, you can shut down branches. So we're looking for those opportunities where, you know, some of this, you know, new, you know, growth stuff can be used on some of our value companies to help them maybe cut costs, maybe help them grow going forward. So we're not totally missing out on it. You know, clearly we don't own the non-dividend payers. They're growing very, very fast. That's just not going to be an area we'll ever be able to be exposed to. But like I said, you get a lot of that in the index right now because they've done so well. And what this fund will provide you is a very healthy dividend yield that's, you know, 50% or greater than the S&P 500 on a gross basis. And then owning you know, some of these real value areas of the market that we've identified that don't have a lot of those secular challenges.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, John. Thank you very much for your time. Really enjoyed the conversation. Have a good trip in the UK and a safe journey back to the US, although I guess you sort of came exclusively for this podcast, so we're very lucky. To our listeners, let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast. Leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. But until next time, many thanks for listening.
Thank you.